My name is Vern Reakey, and I live in Seattle, Washington. I am a teacher at the School of Law at the University of Washington. Once upon a time, a long time ago, I was a real lawyer. Practiced briefly. By strange twist of fate, I agreed to substitute as a teaching person in the School of Law for 1 year and never found the door out again. So I'm still there. One of the courses that I offer is a course in family law, sometimes called domestic relations. It's a law which deals with marriage, termination of marriage, problems of custody and support, and the other things that are related to that. This morning, I'd like to talk with you about living arrangements. The title on the board, you know, is Married and Unmarried, and Where Are We Going? The other patterns of living in companionship with other persons. There is no one today who knows how many persons are living in what kind of arrangements. That information just is not available to us. I wish it were. The last census figures that I am aware of goes back not to the 1980 census, but the 1970 census. An awful lot's changed since then. Showed that in the 10 years that census measured, there was about a 300% increase in what the census people called persons living together without being married to each other. Then you got looking at that, and you found out that that included people who were sharing apartment space, who were sharing houses, and might or might not have anything to do with anything more than sharing the cost of electricity and heat and light and paying tax and something of that sort. So you get a whole welter of different kinds of arrangements. That's part of the problem. But I have no doubt that there are more people living together in something which is very, very similar to a marital arrangement without being officially married today than there were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I think that's true. Although I'm not sure about that. And one has to stay sort of loose about making those judgments. Yesterday, for those of you who shared my hour of confusion, I was trying to talk about what marriage is. And I hope that I persuaded those of you who were here that you must look at marriage from several different functional criteria. Now, marriage is a wonderful governmental device. It's about the best way that we have of organizing tax structures and inheritance structures and a whole lot of other governmental functions. That's not bad. Government is better than chaos. Maybe just barely, but at least I think it's movement in the right direction. Otherwise, I would not be a lawyer. You know, if I thought there was something basically inherently wrong with government and law, I hope that I would have the integrity not to be involved in government and in law. Well, also one can think of marriage as being an attempt for two people to live together, who love each other, who want to share their life together. Yesterday, I characterized that as being the warm and fuzzy aspects of marriage. Law doesn't have much to do with the warm and fuzzy aspects of life. The presupposition of law is that law keeps people from doing violence to each other, so that hopefully in these little islands of peace and relative tranquility, people can maximize their life experiences more productively than they could if they were busy beating each other with sticks. And I mentioned yesterday one of my heroes, a fellow officer in the organization that I was with in the military, who was interviewed in the middle of a serious battle. And he was asked what he thought about all of the violence and bloodshed that was going around the moment. And he, being a lawyer, said that he thought that the real estate question in dispute would be better settled in the courts. I mean, that's better than violence, and I agree with that. Now, what I'm trying to say is that to really maximize our life relationships, to have them rich with the warm and fuzzy aspects of life, where you live with someone productively, maybe even reproductively, enriching each other's experiences is not the same thing as collecting taxes. Our laws and our Bible are full of words which we use rather unthinkingly and maybe interchangeably. Family. What's a family? Household. What's a household? Married. What's married? My pastor, who is not married and has no children and lives by herself in an apartment, says that she is a household. And she is. At least by definition of the Internal Revenue Service, she is a household. And she says that she rejoices in that fact, and we do too, because we can go visit her in her household. She is a member of a family. She has a father and mother, fine people I've met. She has other relatives, and a family sort of carries the connotation, doesn't it, of being related to each other, either biologically or by certain legal arrangements, adoption, parenthood, marriage, that's family. Now, married is different. And no fair using those words interchangeably. They mean different things, and they have different objectives. I mean, what you're trying to accomplish with those things, not necessarily the same. And when you have somebody who doesn't want to meet all of the qualifications of one of these things, try to reach over and grab all the benefits of something else without also accepting the responsibilities of that arrangement. I mean, if you are a goat and you want to be a camel, because camels get to wear bells that goats don't, it's no fair to say that you are a camel and go around growing horns and butting people. I mean, you got to be a camel if you want to be a camel. And if that doesn't make any sense to you, and maybe it doesn't, what I'm trying to say is that we have different styles of addressing problems, and each one of them has its patterns, and it's both its benefits and its burdens, and that people choose, and we ought to be able to choose, which of these will accomplish the responsibilities and the benefits most productively for the persons who are involved in it. About 20 years ago, I first started helping people write contracts for cohabitation without marriage. I'm sure I was not the first person in the world to do that, because I've read some cases that arose out of such contracts dating about 1860, 1870. It didn't work much better then. I mean, they got into court then too, some of them. About 5 years after I started privately engaging in that kind of legal practice, I gave an examination to some of my students. How would you write a contract for a man and woman who did not want to marry each other but wanted to live together and wanted to be protected from things like disagreements about property, disagreements about sharing expenses, and so forth? How would you write such a contract? The class that I was working with at that time was about 30, 35 students. Two of the students got up and walked out. One student wrote an examination question, which was one of the shorter examination answers I've ever had. That student's answer was, I would tell them to get out of my office and never come to me for services again. Now, here were at least three students, roughly 10%, of the class, which said that this whole notion is so repulsive to me that I, as a professional person, a lawyer, would refuse to even discuss with these people a need which these people were trying to get on top of. Were my students who walked out on me right or wrong? Should that be our approach? You know, you people want to do something which is just so repulsive that I won't even tackle the problem with you. Right? Wrong. That's a beautiful answer. Lawyers do that all the time, of course. Now, that's a terrible thing to do. I never want to do that myself. It's a crummy idea. Now let's see I can help you with it. Would you expect a clergyman to talk to those people about that idea? Or should a clergyman say, get out of here, you sinner, and when you have repented and are living properly, come back and I'll talk to you after you don't need me anymore. Is the clergyman different from the lawyer in this respect, or do you agree that one ought to be able to help people even though you don't agree with their objectives? You all understand what you're saying at this point?
It's different professionally as an attorney with your responsibility towards the law and as an attorney. The ethics is a different attorney.
Clergyman is more or less a counselor.
Some lawyers carry cards which say lawyer and counselor at law. Do you think lawyers are not?
That wasn't the right word.
I understand what you mean. I understand what you mean. Yes, ma'am.
Would the clergyman be what you would expect of a clergyman agreeing to try to help them? Would he be trying to help them accomplish their purpose or the satisfaction?
Or to talk it out of, talk them out of it. What should be the professional approach at that time? Now, sir and madam, you have an objective and a purpose that you'd like to serve. I do not agree that that's a good one. Therefore, I will now try to dissuade you. And if I cannot dissuade you, I will stand and, as graciously as possible, open the door to my office and kick you out. Yes, ma'am.
What about another professional example? A pharmacist to whom someone comes asking for strychnine to poison someone.
Let me explain to you how strychnine works. I don't advise you to use it this way, but if you're going to have strychnine, you ought to know as much about it as possible. Yes, ma'am.
I don't think you can totally segregate the lawyer's profession from what he's responsible for. Lawyers deal supposedly strictly with the law, but they also have to be ethical people because they have a big influence on our society and what direction the society goes. So I don't think that you should unconditionally accept people that want these type of contracts and not try to dissuade them if you personally believe that.
I frequently advise my clients, I don't think you ought to do that. Because if you do it, you're going to run into these kinds of problems. I mean, your tax rate's going to go up, you're going to confuse the title to your property, and blah, 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 a whole bunch of other things. You got a long, hard road to go on this one. If it is something which is positively illegal, I say, I advise you not to do it. And if they say, how can we do it and get away with it, I say, this is the point in which I get off. Because as just been indicated, we all have ethical responsibilities, and there comes a point in which you say, no, I cannot help you by furnishing you strychnine to kill somebody. On the other hand, if somebody comes and says, I'd like to set up a business venture in the following way, and I say that's not the most likely way to succeed, you will encounter these problems. If you go another direction, you won't encounter those problems. They say, yeah, but I want to try it this way. I said, well, do you understand what your risks are? That's what a lawyer is, basically. Here are your risks. You know, lawyers professionally always see the hole in the donut. Other people see the donut. Come to a lawyer and he will tell you, I can give you 16 ways that you can get in trouble. Now, if you understand what your problems are and you still want to go that direction, and if it's not unlawful, fattening or immoral, then I will help you. Even though it would not be my personal choice.
As a Christian, how do you justify that?
By saying that God has given us at least two sets of tools to work with. One tool we call gospel and one tool we call law. And both gospel and law are ways in which we relate to other people. They are ways of living with other people. One is much richer than the other. My wife and I have had 36 pretty good years. She's been reasonable most of the time. We have gradually developed a relationship where seldom do we get up in the morning and pull out the revised code of Washington and read the rule to each other. Almost always we are able to maximize the effectiveness of our relationship because I truly love her and she tolerates me fairly well. Maybe more. She gets her inning later. I'm trying to illustrate the fact that God has given us a relationship called community, being in communion, being concerned about each other, which is not self-serving, which is a commitment to other people. We live in love and we follow a pattern of confidence and trust and servanthood, tough words, each one of which deserves at least an hour's discussion. And then we have another pattern over here where we are unable to live in that particular richness, but must live with other people. We must live with them in the world. Then it's better to live in the poverty of law than it is in abject violence and chaos. I do not believe, I'd like to make the point as clearly as I can, that constitutional rights are rich, they are poverty. It's the minimum levels that we can accept. The best test for something which is unconstitutional is this. If you see what's being done and you want to throw up, it's probably unconstitutional. If you can keep down your breakfast, it's probably constitutional. See, it's the minimum levels because law always implicates force. Mr. Justice Holmes once said, there is no law except in the end of a policeman's nightstick. If there's no way of enforcing it, you don't have any right, because every right has a duty, which is enforceable. The gospel is not that way. The gospel is not self-serving. Now, believe it or not, I'm trying to respond to your question. As a Christian, I would elect not to engage in legal relationships with other people. But where that is impossible to relate to somebody because they will not relate in that kind of mutual confidence, mutual trust, mutual desire to serve each other and be servants of each other, then I must live with them, and therefore law is better than chaos. Now let's try and be specific about these notions that we've been developing here in connection with the problem we're talking about today. Shortly after I gave my somewhat ill-fated examination to my students, the only time I've ever had students walk out and say, flunk me if you dare, you immoral critter. Shortly after that, I got a telephone call from a friend of mine who was on the theological faculty at St. Louis, Missouri, Missouri Lutheran Church. And he said, we have learned about an examination that you've just given. I thought, oh man, you are really in trouble. And we would like for you to come back and talk to us about that problem. They were even willing to buy me an airplane ticket to go up there. Well, after getting the best advice that my wife could give me as to whether or not I ought to wear armor plate or not, I decided to go back and we talked about that. a theological, a group of persons, not the entire theological faculty, a group of persons from that faculty and I, theologians and lawyers, and I was prepared for the worst, and I got the best. I got people who were really concerned about whether or not human beings are being served by our patents. They didn't really care much about my problems, about trying to set up a more efficient system of passing title from one generation to another, or warding off creditors. They recognize that those are important things in our life together. They are. But they saw beyond that to some other objectives. And we had an excellent discussion, and it encouraged me greatly. A community in Long Island, New York, enacted a zoning law which said that they thought it was better if houses in a certain part of Long Island would be single-family residences. Single-family residences. And that no house there could be occupied by more than one family. Hello, I'm using a word, a magic word, family. Some young people who were attending one of the colleges nearby found that it was advantageous to them to live in the house together, share expenses, heat, light, rent, tax, all of those things, share groceries, and so forth. And they were told by the municipal government of that portion of Long Island that they had to move out because they were violating the ordinance law, which said that the house could be occupied only by a single family. And they said, you are violating a constitutional protection that we have. You are treating us unequally. You are denying us equal protection of the law because you permit a family. There may be 20 people in that family. You know, the city was going on about, well, we don't want too much density. We don't want too many people living per square mile. We don't want too many people driving cars. So these young people said, look, there may be 5, 10, 15 people in a family living in that house. Population density may be out of sight. We're a rather small number, and we're not going to overcrowd this thing. We'd like to be reasonable about this. It's an unequal protection. Your classification of family is really traditional morality hidden under some irrational notions about density and so forth, density of population and so forth. Therefore, it is an irrational distinction between a group of people and a group of people. And therefore, since it's not equal protection, 14th Amendment, Federal Constitution, it is unconstitutional, and your ordinance is invalid. It's unconstitutional. That case got to the United States Supreme Court. Mr. Justice Douglas wrote the majority opinion, and you are now to tell me what his opinion was. Was the zoning ordinance, private family only, constitutional or unconstitutional? Constitutional? I'm sorry, I missed the unconstitutional.
I would say it's constitutional.
Constitutional, but that's what makes a lawsuit. We now have both opinions, yes.
You have to give a definition of a family. And I think this couple is a family.
I will tell you what the definition was, because you're quite right. The definition in that ordinance was that any persons who were biologically related to each other or who were related to each other by marriage or adoption, and not more than two people who were not related, either biologically or by adoption or by marriage, constituted a family. So you had two people unrelated or any number related by marriage, biology, or adoption.
Well, how many students were wanted to live in this?
Five.
In the state of Washington, isn't it five people unrelated?
Five people and unrelated? I don't know.
I think that's the law here.
An ordinance someplace?
Under
I don't know.
To a family.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I just don't know the answer
to that. We had a case in Mount Edward just this
summer. Yeah. Well, you know, now I've got a unconstitutional and a constitutional. May I hear your reasons?
Well, because we're pretty sure that the decision there said that these two people did constitute a family. But you have five, and you introduced that just now.
There are more than the permissible number of unbiologically, unmarried, unadopted. You get five instead of two. Does that make a difference to you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You don't think that it's unconstitutional discrimination?
Well, as long as the Supreme Court said not more than two.
The municipal council of the community in Long Island adopted the ordinance. The college students were saying the ordinance is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court is asked to determine whether or not the ordinance adopted by the local municipality is unconstitutional or not. And you are now a judge in the United States Supreme Court trying to decide whether it's constitutional or not.
I missed one of your curves.
Ah.
Does it boil down to, does a community have the right to legislate morality?
Mr. Justice Brennan said that was exactly the question. He said, I know what those folks are trying to do. They're a bunch of old fogies who don't want college students living together because they're afraid of what's going on. Sort of like a pastor that I heard once who just came back from visiting St. Olaf, and he was greatly distressed. He says, there's fornication under every brush, under every bush. I don't know how he spent his time, apparently out. Yes, ma'am.
I don't think of it in morality terms at all. I feel that if a community is a single family community, and you choose to live in a single family community, then you have to follow the laws of that community. And I would say that it would depend on the law of what they constitute, how many, like she says in Washington, it's under five. I would think that they should follow those laws, because you move into a community because you don't want, say, 20 college students living in one house.
Would you want 20 people in the same family living in the same house?
If it were a family. But see, you're getting into something other than a family.
What makes the difference between a family and a non-family if we're talking about numbers?
Number of bedrooms in the house.
Number of bedrooms in the house.
But I would have something.
Maybe.
Well, for one thing, if they are 20 separate people, they probably have 20
separate cars.
20 separate cars. And they're going in 20 separate ways, whereas a family have much more loyalty toward each other. You also have more problems with 20 separate people than 20 separate families. But I still feel it's a judgment of I don't know what Justice Douglas decided, because knowing just of him, it would be difficult to say how he would go. But I would feel that it's up to you to, I think a community has a right to have
a... Mr. Justice Douglas did write the majority opinion in this case.
Yeah.
Unconstitutional. Huh. Actually, he said it's just as constitutional as it can be. He surprised you, didn't he? Yes, ma'am.
Well, weren't the students being asked to move out of the neighborhood when they'd already been living there when it was
Yes.
What you said about 20 separate cars in the first place, college students don't have enough money for 20 separate cars.
Motorcycles.
I don't have enough money to spend next year on a moped to get around to campus. I mean, I'm working my way through. And I think that when people make a commitment, you have, well, in the first place, there's going to be a lot of studying, and you have to learn to live with the people you're around, so there's not going to be problems there. And they make a decision to share that home wherever they are because of economic problems, or maybe they just want company. I don't think it's immoral, or
uh-huh.
I don't think it's a problem at all.
Let's shift the facts just a little bit. Leave Long Island, go to East Cleveland. Another zoning law, another zoning ordinance. Pardon?
You forgot to tell us why you decided it's constitutional.
Wow. We'll get there. Maybe. East Cleveland adopts the zoning ordinance, single family. Now they say, you know, families, you know, as I said yesterday, in my family, I've got ancestors that go back a long way. You know, I've not only got grandfathers, I've got great-grandparents, and they go back, I don't know when my family started, but an awful big family. It goes downhill, too. Maybe you've got ancestors, I don't know. Family could be an awful lot of people. And East Cleveland said, we don't want 50 people living in a house. That's what we're trying to get around. So they define family as being not only the persons that you were married to and that you adopted, but also your direct descendants and your direct ascendants. And no fair branching off into kissing cousins and everything like that. A grandmother had a house, and she was caring for two grandchildren. But the grandchildren were not from the same of her children. In other words, they were cousins, not siblings. Okay? And therefore, they didn't meet the zoning ordinance of East Cleveland. They were not direct descendants. And so the people told her, you gotta get rid of one of the grandkids or move out. And she said, now, just a moment. Hell hath no fury like a grandmother aroused. I know, I'm married to one. She said, that's as unconstitutional as the day is long. And Cleveland said, go read Village of Belle Terre against Boras, the other case, where Mr. Justice Douglas decided that that zoning ordinance was perfectly constitutional. She says, yeah, but this is different. Well, of course it's different. It's in East Cleveland, and there are grandchildren rather than college students. But is that any kind of an important difference? That got to the United States Supreme Court, too. How do you decide that? Your reasoning now, the facts, you know, the logic behind the decision is going to become very important now. How do you decide Moore against East Cleveland? You understand, excuse me, you understand the facts? Everybody okay on the facts? All right.
She only had to get rid of one grandchild.
Well, she could keep any number of grandchildren as long as they were direct descendants of one, you know, one direct line. No fair branching out. No cousins.
What was her defense, or what was her rationale? The same as the...
She said that the zoning ordinance was unconstitutional.
Same thing. Then.
Yeah. She said it's unconstitutional because it's an irrational, unreasonable distinction and therefore violates equal protection. You know, grandmothers with cousins are entitled to the same protection as grandmothers with direct descendants of one of their children. Yeah.
I would wonder if in the United States, if those cases often come up, I always felt that a single family house was when if you deviated from a single family house, you had a separate apartment. But a single family house would be one that just has one living space. You have any number of bathrooms, for instance. But when you went other than a single family house, then you had a separate kitchen.
Yep. Almost every zoning ordinance will have its definition of what a family is. That's one of the great games we're playing right now. You know, how to write the zoning ordinance so it's constitutional.
We had something just recently in where we live, where in a single family neighborhood, a man wanted to take in Japanese students who would be gone all day, and they're very quiet. They're
not like cars, they're teenagers.
No motorcycles. They had no cars. No anything. And they wouldn't allow him to do it because they said then he had a boarding house. And they only have 9 students.
Do I understand what you're saying, that if you were on the Supreme Court and Moore against East Cleveland, you would say the statute is unconstitutional?
I would, yes.
Yeah? How many of you think that the East Cleveland statute is unconstitutional? Now, if you say that, you've got to distinguish it from the Boras case in Long Island. Doesn't have to be a very good reason, but you got to have a reason. All right, let's take a vote, shall we? How many say East Cleveland ordinance is unconstitutional? How many say constitutional? Oh, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but you are violating rule number 1 again. You are now a court, and you may not not vote. I know that you don't know the answer. No judge ever knows the answer. I'm serious about that, because no problem with an answer ever goes to court. And if there's a sensible answer in advance, people don't pay $10,000 to hear a judge announce what they already know. It's only those cases which don't have a scientific or legal, scientific or predictable answer. Those are the ones that go to court to be resolved. So I'm sorry, you cannot not vote. And the state law prohibits that. If you do not vote, you do not get your paycheck. That is the law of the state of Washington. You would be surprised how many judges go a month or two without getting their salary because they can't get their stomach in order to vote one way or the other. All right, let's do it again. How many of you justices say that the ordinance of East Cleveland is unconstitutional? You gotta vote or I'll put thumbscrews on you. All right. All right, and those who say it's constitutional? Oh, you sinners, you're still not voting for me. But all right, you can't make up your mind, can you? All right. But of those of you who voted, the majority of the voters said that it was unconstitutional. What's the difference between that and the Long Island case? Well, the court said that the difference is because you had a family in the East Cleveland case. And the law may not interfere with a family because families are constitutionally protected. In the words of Mr. Justice Douglas, very interesting words, the family has a sanctity. It is a state of intimacy which is sacred. Huh. These are kind of funny words for lawyers to be using, aren't they? Or are they? Whereas college students living together is not sacred. It's just useful and convenient. It's just a helpful way of living and therefore ought to be smashed. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I was going to say that whole thing of definition of family, and how do you relate this on the theological question of corporateness? And why are these laws in there in the first place? I mean, it seems to me that a lot of times they're for the land owner or the property owner and not for people, and we're getting away from this. I mean, to me, it makes me have a real sick feeling about our society.
I mean, you've got a sneaking suspicion that there are not very many people on welfare elected to the legislature? Now, where do laws come from is the question, really, the rules come from. And here, if I can digress for just a moment and try to answer that, still in the context of what we are talking about this morning, why are Roman Catholic priests unable to marry? You know, they could marry until about the 7th century. At the time of the schism between the Eastern Orthodox and the Catholic Church, Eastern Orthodoxy has never had a problem with priests marrying. Bishops, sorry about that, but my bishop is sitting here. He's thoroughly married. Therefore, he's not a very good bishop by definition. But in the division of the Eastern and the Western Church back in those centuries, the West said to their priests, pretty soon you may not marry. The East never did say that. Why?
Costs more to support a priest with a wife.
Partly, although my own research into this subject stumbles across something else which is rather interesting. Bad lawyering in Italy. Land had to be held by a living human being. There was yet no corporation in which you could vest the title of land. That's step number one. Step number two was that if a person who owned land had legitimate children, the land had to pass to the children. It could not be given to another priest or another bishop so that the church would keep its property. That was true in Italy. Over in the Eastern area, where the Eastern Orthodox Church was, they'd figured out the corporation earlier. So the church's land vested in a corporation. You didn't have to worry about whether or not your priests that had title to the land married or not. I'm sorry about that. And so the church said to the bishops, it is your godly duty not to get married. Because if you do, you're going to have legitimate children and the church will lose its land. Well, they didn't either say any such thing. They said, it's your godly duty to be married to the church. And somebody probably thought, and that's one way we can keep the land. Marriage gets distorted away from what is it that maximizes the interpersonal relationships of human beings. It's in some senses, is manipulation by people who've got the muscle. Your point, isn't it? And you see how that happens, and you see that's what we're talking about this morning. The case of Organization for Foster Parents and the Reform of the Laws, sometimes called the case of OFFER, O-F-F-E-R, the acronym for Organization of Foster Families for the Reform of the Laws. Foster people had children, foster children. They had lived with these children and formed a firm relationship with these children. The children regarded them as being their parents. This was in New York. The foster parents loved the kids loved the foster parents. They'd never adopted them. They were not theirs biologically. And the Department of Social Security in New York, or whatever the name of the commission is that handles that, one day announced that they were going to take these children and move them out of this foster parent to someplace else. And the foster parents said, you can't take our children away from us that way. And they said, we're not your children. You didn't give birth to them. You are not a family. And the foster parents said, what do you mean we're not a family? We relate to these children as affectionately, as firmly. They regard us as being their parents just as much, more perhaps, than if they had been born to us or adopted to us, or if they were our grandchildren or something like that. We are even better than Moore against East Cleveland. We are a functioning family. And the New York commissioner said, you're not a family. You're not protected in the right to relate to these children and keep them. The foster parents said, that's unconstitutional. I want to throw up. If you can just take our children away from us that way. Is that law which permits the state to go in and take the foster children away from the parents without all of the same protections that natural parents would get, constitutional or unconstitutional? Please resolve the question promptly, because I've got more to torture you with. Constitutional or unconstitutional?
Constitutional.
A scattering of ages. This was an organization of foster parents that went all the way from birth to majority.
This is how we think the law rules, not how we feel personally.
It's got to be what is our law. That's right. Yes, sir.
I think it has to be constitutional, because the state would have to license them to be foster parents in the first place, so that the state could also then remove their status as foster parents if they wanted to.
A footnote in that case paraphrased what you've just said, and it also paraphrased scripture. It says, the law gives and the law taketh away. It's a little different.
But they're not legally there because they don't have papers.
That's right. And just because they love each other, just because they relate well to each other, just because they enrich each other's life, there's no reason to protect the relationship.
Why were they being removed?
Economic reasons. It's cheaper to keep them someplace else. Put them in a warehouse. You know, you don't have to have a foster parent with one foster parent for every six kids or something. You can put them in a warehouse and run a ratio of 1 to 50. Keep them drugged or sedated. I'm making the case stronger than it was. As far as I know, New York does not warehouse quite that inhumanely, but that's the basic reason. And now, of course, we're off into a whole new, is that a good idea or a bad idea to treat children that way? But that's not what I want you to center on. Do foster parents have the protection that natural parents or adoptive parents or that married persons would have?
No.
Oh, boy, you are hard-hearted enough to make excellent lawyers.
Maybe you put a child in a foster home where it wouldn't be that loving relationship, so
Foster parents could have adopted.
Foster parents could have adopted, yes. Sometimes the biological parents will not release them for adoption. And they won't take care of them either.
Foster parents cannot adopt the foster children.
Many places, those are the rules that a foster parent may not adopt because the state doesn't want to lose control. All right, now we're spinning out here into beautiful questions, and if we had 30 more hours, we could talk about them, but I don't want to talk about that right now. I want to talk about this case now. Singer against Hera. Singer against Hera arose in Seattle. Mr. Singer went down to the county auditor, and Mr. Hera was the county auditor. Mr. Singer wanted to take out a marriage license. Auditor's staff said, well, that's what we do down here. We issue licenses all the time. Can we help you, Mr. Singer? You got the $5? Yeah, I got the $5. And who is going to be the bride? Well, that's my roommate, Joe. I beg your pardon? Now, Joe and I are going to get married. And Mr. Singer, surely you jest. No, Mr. Hera, we do not jest. We have just discovered that for purposes of tax and for purposes of property and purposes of exemption from the claims of our creditors and all of that good stuff that marriage can do, it's the cheapest, the best planning device that lawyers have yet been able to devise. We get this great big package of stuff without working it out item by item by item by item. It's just faster, cheaper, more economical, and it will enrich our lives if you just let us get married. Mr. Singer, surely you do jest. You don't expect me to issue a marriage license to two men. I do, sir. Mr. Harris said, out, out, out. He behaved about like the students in my examination. Never darkened my door with such an idea again. So Mr. Singer sued Harris. And he said that he and Joe were entitled to a marriage license. After all, they are just as much entitled to the protection of law as a man and a woman. Is that right? I'm sorry?
How did the state law read?
State law read that if two persons who are the right age and are not insane and who don't have a venereal disease and, you know, apply for a marriage license, they get it. Oh, it's been amended since then, I assure you. And Mr. Singer and Joe said, we're persons. Here we are. You are evading the issue, I don't think.
Does that invade that sanctity of what the family is that you talked about earlier?
Well,
families
can be by birth, by adoption, or by marriage. And Singer and Joe said, we want to be a family, and since we're not born in the same family, and since we actually they could have adopted each other. I have advised people in this situation, one of them, to adopt the other. No reason why, you know, there's no reason why Jane couldn't adopt me if it were advantageous, but that's a diversion. They said, we want to do it the quick, easy, fast way. Adoption is relatively tough. $5 for a marriage license and scuffling the leaves in the park and we're married and we got all of this good stuff. Mr. Harris said, I got my doubts about you people. You may be gay. And Singer said, Mr. Harris, are you questioning my motives? And Harris, no, maybe. All right, let's get off it. Is that refusal on the part of Hera to issue a marriage license to two men?
Yeah.
Constitutional or unconstitutional?
Unconstitutional.
It's constitutional. The state may refuse to allow two men to get married or two women to get married
right.
to each other.
Right.
Why?
It all depends on what the law.
Yes, ma'am.
It's not biblical anyway.
Contrary to nature.
It's again nature.
Other laws that aren't biblical, but, you know, I think it's unconstitutional because it's not equal. There's no equality here. There's one case that is the people are being discriminated against, and this other case, they're not, just because they're one way.
Yeah. I want you now all to think what we're saying to each other.
This goes back to yesterday's talk about married life.
Yeah, does.
Sure does.
Yeah. One way we're saying to each other that God instructs us in the Bible to live legally and forget grace. And you say that? Oh, you didn't say that. I said that. It just sounds to me like maybe you're more hung up on law than you are on grace. I mean, yeah, okay, let's be honest with each other. You really suspect the motivations of Singer and Joe, don't you? Shame on you, suspicious people.
You know, years ago, I read an article, and I can't remember too much about it, telling why marriage, you know, we think that we've always thought marriage is love, you know, I mean, you fall in love and you get
warm, fuzzy.
And, yeah, and they said that marriage actually was set up as a structure for society. I mean, to add...
Organize society.
Organize society and to add...
Tax, society. Inheritance, mm-hmm. Exemption from claims creditors. I can't resist a side story, and then I want to ask you about another case. Jane and I had a son who attended Oberlin College for a while. He happened to be there at the time that Life magazine came out with a cover story about boys and girls living together in the same room without being married. And one of our fine neighbors, a fine woman, came up the hill and said, "Look, and your son is at Oberlin." And we said, "Yes, he is, but we don't think there's anything inappropriate going on with our son. When he comes home in a couple weeks for vacation, you can ask him."
Oh.
Okay, you're coming to the good part now. We didn't think she would, but when Paul came home a couple weeks later, she came up with her copy of Life. And she braced him on the subject and said, "Is this true?" And he said, "It's worse." Because at Oberlin, it is simply the fact that in some of the rooms there are two boys living together. Side story. Okay. In the state of Washington, there was a woman out of Canada, French-Canadian descent, who was pretty good at taking care of livestock and cattle. And there was a man who had separated from his wife. She lived down in Wenatchee. He lived up the Mettow Valley. She was doing things that you do in Wenatchee, pursuing culture, and he was up taking care of cattle. And he made an arrangement with this woman to help him take care of cattle. He had emphysema and couldn't get around so much anymore. She was good at rearing cattle. They had a prosperous farm, had good black Hereford cattle. Okay? They also had four children. Yeah. They raised black Herefords and children. He told her that he would regard her as his spouse and that he would see to it that she was paid an adequate amount of money for everything that she did and that he would provide for her in his will when he finally ran out of air and died, which he did. And he didn't leave a will, and he didn't give her a check, and he didn't set up a trust, and she filed a claim against his estate for the money which she says he owed her. His wife swam upstream from Wenatchee and said, "That contract, if there was one, between this woman and my husband is simply invalid, and she ought not to get a dime. And I, as his wife, even though I lived downstream, we hadn't seen each other for pretty close to 20 years, I ought to inherit all the property." All right, you wizards. Who goes home with the money?
I thought the Lee Marvin case set the precedent.
The Lee Marvin case relied on the Washington case. Marvin cited the Washington case for its decision.
You had the cat out of the bag.
Yeah, you sure did.
For those of you who don't follow that kind of talk on the side, the suggestion is that the Washington court held that the woman was entitled to have the contract enforced, although she had been, as Justice Douglas would might have said, living in sin. She was also living in Omak, I think it was. Is that wrong? Watch yourself now. You're about to get into a peck of trouble. You are about to...
Morally, it might have been wrong, but legally it was right.
Morally, did you say?
Morally, the fact she was living out of wedlock was wrong, but legally... She should have.
You mean she should be put in jail, although she gets the money?
No, I don't think morally you're put in jail all the time, but legally she
should
have
be?
Gotten the money because she was. She had contributed to earning the money, and she had been living with him.
Yeah.
And the other wife was not a wife, even though she was legally a wife. She was not a wife.
Marvin was overturned anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We'll one step at a time and we'll get there.
I think your case demonstrates why we have courts of equity as well as courts of law.
Uh-huh. More magic words being used now. That's true, you know, in the development of the law, there were the judges of the law who announced what the law was and said that therefore you have to be executed under the law, and then there was equity, which was the church, the chancellor, who said that that's absolutely right under the law, however, under equity, it really shouldn't happen, and therefore, the equity will stop the law from enforcing its vengeance on this person. We do that, of course, in Washington and other states all the time. A court orders something to be done, and the governor quivers with indignation and grants pardon. It's law and equity going on here. But back to this poor woman. Please, those of you who feel that she ought to get the money, let's see your hands.
Which poor woman?
This is the black Hereford reared raising woman in Washington. Those of you who think she ought not. The state Supreme Court said without difficulty, the contract, if there is one, is of course enforceable. The fact that they were sinning on the side doesn't mean that you shouldn't enforce the contract. You know, if a man and a woman go into business together to sell socks in a grocery store, and they're partners, the fact that they happen to engage in fornication doesn't mean that they can't enforce their contract. And so they send it back to the trial court and said, enforce the contract. Next step, and then we'll get to Marvin. The next step was the trial court said to the woman, all right, now, about this contract that you say that you had, tell us about its terms. And she says, well, it was just an understanding. Oh, nothing written? No, nothing written. What do you mean it was an understanding? Well, we understood each other. Court said, prove it. She said, well, I just told you so. Court says, you know, you can't even talk about that because he's dead and you might be lying. Prove it with some other evidence. She said, I haven't got any other evidence. Court says, well, in that case, you can't prove a contract, and so you lose. Well, if you can't prove a contract, you can't prove a contract. Now let's talk about Lee, Marvin, and Michelle. The California case, which relied upon the Washington Supreme Court decision. The interesting thing about the Marvin case was that the man promised the woman that if she would come in and do some things, you know, run his household, receive guests, provide services, PR services, and so forth, and also live with him in an unmarried relationship, that he would pay her an amount of money, get the terms of this contract, that he would provide her this salary for life. In addition to giving her half of everything that he received during the time that they were in this contractual arrangement, he would then provide for her for life. Boy, talk about good contract terms. That's so much better than marriage, where you only get paid during the time the relationship still continues. Fine. So pretty soon that relationship, she wasn't such a good PR expert, I guess. Whatever it was that Mr. Marvin did not like, and so he, or she, or they, or somebody splits. And she says to the court, now enforce the contract. And the court says, oh, please get out of here. I smell something. You're like Singer and Joe coming into O'Hara and asking for a marriage license. I had a contract. Oh, more than that. I suspect that you were playing around. And therefore, you are an immoral person, and therefore, we won't enforce the contract. Well, Michelle at this point whips out the Washington case and says, does California want to be behind Washington in progress? Well, that got them. Of course not. So the court says, well, in California, of course, if the contract is one where the exchange money for is based upon something other than sexual services, we still don't enforce contracts for prostitution, not even in California. But to the extent that it's for services other than sexual services, it's enforceable. So they went down to the trial court again to figure out how much the contract was worth, and she had exactly the same experience that the woman in Washington did. Trial judge said, matter of fact, I don't find the contract that you're talking about. You didn't have any partnership. You didn't have a corporation. You have no evidence of any kind of a contract, and I'm sorry, you just haven't proved your case. And she said, I'll starve to death. And the judge did something very weird then in California. He said, you know, I really feel sorry for you, and I think I'll take off my law hat here for a moment and put on my equity hat. And now I'm a chancellor in equity, and I don't think he treated you very well, and I think you ought to have $100,000 just to, we'll call it palimony, just to kind of get you back into running order. And Marvin said, why? You know, there's no contract, there's no partnership, there's no corporation, there's no marriage. What's the reason for it? The judge says, she needs it. That was the basis of the Marvin Award to Michelle. That one was then appealed to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court said, now, just a moment here. You can't do that. There are a lot of people who need things, and just because they need it and I've got it is no reason why the court can order me to give it to them. And so they reversed it, and poor Michelle, who rather recently was arrested for shoplifting, that's the extent to which she's been reduced, you know. Matter of fact, it was her second conviction, as I understand it, for shoplifting. Well, you got to make a living someplace, somehow. And her other natural assets apparently have been rather badly depreciated. You get the reversal of this thing, and now she is out. And it's now virtually time for us to go eat, and we got to quit. Does this help at all in trying to understand that we must differentiate between the legal aspects of a relationship, tax, inheritance, support, money, and the emotional, theological relationships which are over here on the other side? To the extent that marriage is a way of running a tax collection system. Well, that's good. I'm in favor of an efficient, good, governmental system. I don't think that people ought to evade legal responsibilities. I think that's wrong. It's even criminal. But I don't confuse that with the question of what is the most productive, genuine, honest commitment that can be put together. I believe that if a couple has not advanced to the stage where they can effectively use Plan A, traditional marriage, and if their decision not to use Plan A is not motivated by a desire to cheat, to defraud, to evade, do something which is unlawful, and if they genuinely commit themselves to a relationship that in their situation holds promise of being more rewarding, I don't mean to them individually, but to them as a community. That's it. Understand all of that. I'm talking about genuine commitment.
to an experience which they can see as being the best that they can do in their situation, I don't think that we ought to be too quick to condemn them for making a choice to do the best that they can with what they've got, the situation they have. I'd like to close with the same place that I came in. Gospel is rich. A loving relationship between two people is the best that you can do. A commitment in the traditional form, I think, is the most rewarding for people who can live in the gospel. But for people who have never heard of the love of Christ, or for people who simply do not understand what it means to be related to each other in a genuine commitment, they've got to live. And we ought to try and structure the most rewarding arrangement that we can for them. I think an appendectomy is a tragedy, except for somebody that needs one to live with. I do not recommend that all of you people who have a good appendix go out and have your appendix out. It's no fun. But if you've really got a ruptured appendix, it's a wonderful thing. I don't recommend variations from a tried, basically workable pattern of relationship. But if you got a ruptured appendix, let's have radical surgery. It seems to me that's where we are. We're entitled to 5 more hours. We haven't got it. Let's go have lunch.